Let's turn to Genesis chapter 49. This morning, in these 2 hours, we will finish the book of Genesis, which is kind of a landmark series for me because it's the first series I've taught of over 100 tapes or 100 classes. But we're getting down to the end now of the life of Jacob and Joseph, and that's what these two chapters will cover. First, we're going to have Jacob predict the future of his sons and their tribes. He's about to die. He looks on his life. He looks back over his life. He's grateful for his life and for the faithfulness of God. And his days here are at an end. His earthly life is at an end. But he sees great things in the future for his sons and their descendants. So it's his descendants as well. And he's going to tell them about that in this section. And this is going to be a prophetic section. He's going to be speaking prophecy. In verse 49, look at verse 1, it says, "Then Jacob summoned his sons and said, 'Assemble yourselves that I may tell you what will befall you in the days to come. Gather together and hear, O sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father.'" Remember, Israel, Jacob, same person. So he's going to tell them what will be the destiny of the sons who will become tribes, of course. The sons are the tribes, except for Joseph, and we'll see why Joseph isn't a tribe in a moment. So that's the content of these two chapters. Here are a list of Jacob's or Israel's sons and who their mothers were. First, by Leah, he had Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. So Leah was the most productive wife. It wasn't the wife he loved, as you'll recall. He loved Rachel. Rachel was his love of his life. And by Rachel, he had Joseph and Benjamin. And since Rachel was his love of his life, Joseph and Benjamin were his favorites, and he made no bones about it. He made Joseph that special coat, you'll recall, that made his brothers so jealous that they sold him into slavery in Egypt. So no question that those were his favorites. And then by Bilhah, now Bilhah and Zilpah were concubines. They weren't wives, but by Bilhah, he had Dan and Naphtali, and by Zilpah, Gad and Asher. And those are the 12 sons of Jacob / Israel. And now he's going to tell on his deathbed what is to become of them. So Genesis 49 gives us a prophetic insight into the history of the Jewish people. Because that's what he's talking about now. He's talking about what's going to become of the Jewish people. Now, Genesis is full of prophecies that have been fulfilled already in history. And as the sons of Jacob stand before him, he's given insight into what their future is to hold for them. In fact, most of the prophecies that we find here were fulfilled in the time of the judges, about 600 to 700 years later. The prophecy concerning Judah, of course, is different because the prophecy concerning Judah began to be filled in the time of David and is yet to be fulfilled at the second coming and the establishment of the millennial kingdom. So these prophecies span clear from the days of the judges to the unknown future. We don't know how long it will be before Christ returns again. So that's what we're looking at. So let's look at Jacob and his sons in 49:3 through 28. And the first one he talks about is Reuben. Reuben, the oldest, of course. and that is in verses 3 and 4. Verse 3 says, Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power, uncontrolled as water. You shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed and you defiled it. He went up to my couch. So Reuben is characterized as one who is uncontrollable as water. Now, this is concluded from the event in Genesis 35:22. Look back at 35, Genesis 35:22. It says, it came about while Israel was dwelling in that land that Reuben went up and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. So Reuben was a stinker. He went and laid with his father's concubine, not his mother. His mother was Leah, but he laid with his father's concubine, Bilhah. So he lost his preeminence because of that. And that's what Jacob or Israel means when he says in verse 4, uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence. So even though he was the firstborn, he did not have the preeminence that was due the firstborn. He's described as uncontrollable as water, and the word uncontrolled is the Hebrew word pahaz here. And what that means is it conveys the idea of instability, recklessness, unbridled license. Just if it feels good, do it. That kind of thing. That was Reuben. If it feels good, do it. And just from one thing to another, to another, to another. Now, in fact, if you look at Judges, and chapter 9 and verse 4, Judges chapter 9 and verse 4, it says, they gave him 70 pieces of silver from the house of Baal-berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows, and they followed him. And that reckless is exactly the same word. So it means reckless. Just do as you please, no authority type of thing. And that was Reuben's characteristic. He was uncontrolled as water. Now, two of the prominent descendants of Reuben were Dathan and Abiram. Remember what those two guys did? Look at number 16. We looked at this before. We'll just skim over it, some of these things that we have already looked at in our study of Genesis. But in number 16, verse 1 to 3, it says, now Korah, the son of Izhar, and the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, on the son of Pelath, the sons of Reuben, took action. So these are two of Reuben's descendants, and they're quite famous for what they did. And they rose up before Moses together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation chosen in the assembly, men of renown. So they were chosen, they were men of renown. And look down at verse 23. Remember what they wanted to do. They got mad because Moses and Aaron got all the fun of being the leaders of Israel. And they say, well, we want to get in on this too. You know, we want to be priests and leaders like Moses and Levi. And down in verse 23, it says, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the congregation, saying, get back from around the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And do you know, of course, what God did in verse 31? It says, as he finished speaking all these words, the ground that was under them split open, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up and their households, all the men who belonged to Korah with their possessions. So they didn't do very well. These descendants of Reuben, who thought they should be priests, they thought they should be the leaders of nation Israel. So they wanted to take over what Moses and Aaron were doing, and it didn't work out too well for them. But these were the descendants then of Reuben. Some of his other descendants wanted to bypass, or wanted to opt out, I should say, of entering the promised land. And you can read about that in Numbers 32, 1 to 5. What happened was they just wanted to opt out. Remember when Israel entered the promised land? They said, we like it here. You know, I don't want to go to the promised land that God has told me to. So they're just totally defiant, totally not worried about anything except their own personal gains. And it's interesting that Reuben never prospered as a tribe in Israel. And you can see that in the censuses in Numbers chapter 1 and chapter 26, if you want to read about the censuses. So Reuben, his tribe didn't produce one prophet, no military leaders, no judges, no important person in Israel's history. Reuben's tribe was just kind of set aside. And that's because he was uncontrolled as water. He just did what he wanted. Now look up at James. You're all sitting there being bored and saying, well, yeah, that's the Old Testament and that doesn't really apply to us. That was before the church age. And look at James 1 up in the New Testament. And James 1, verse 5, it says, but if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But he must ask in faith without any doubting, for the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. Now there's an example of Reuben's tribe, isn't it? Tossed by the wind, uncontrolled as water. They're just everywhere doing what feels good. And verse 7 says, for that man ought not to expect that he will receive anything from the Lord, being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. So instability will lead us to not getting blessing from the Lord, materially speaking. Of course, we already have spiritual blessings from the Lord. But if you just run around and do whatever you want, ignore God's word, and do what feels good, you can't expect God to bless that and to give you blessing for it. And this is a perfect example of it. Reuben's tribe is a perfect example of it. They never prospered. They were just kind of there. Yep, there's old Reuben's tribe. Now we have Simeon and Levi. Simeon and Levi were brothers, and they were brothers in more than one sense. They were, of course, the second and third sons of Jacob and Leah, so they were physical brothers, and they were also brothers in the sense of their outlook and their interests. Let's read this, 5 through 7 in chapter 49 of Genesis. Verse 5 says, Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their counsel. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. Because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. So first he says they're violent, And their violence is, you know, violence in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing. God has brought up many warriors in the past, but their violence was self-willed violence. And that makes all the difference in the world, doesn't it? Because there's a godly violence and there's a self-willed violence. Now, what this is talking about, the violence here, is described in Genesis 34. Look back at Genesis 34. Remember the rape of Dinah in Genesis 34? We've had a lot of stuff in Genesis, haven't we? It's kind of hard to remember all the things we've learned over these last 101 classes that we've had. But in chapter 34, verses 1 and 2 says, "Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. And when Shechem saw the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force." So Dinah was raped. And what happens is, well, look down at verse 8 and 9. It says, "But Hamor spoke with them, saying, 'The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage. Intermarry with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves.'" That was not to be, of course. But look it down at verse 14 and 15. "They said to them, 'We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us.'" So Jews would not intermarry with people who weren't Jews and weren't circumcised. So they pulled a little trick. They said, "Only on verse 15, only on this condition will we consent to you if you will become like us, in that every male of you be circumcised." So they said, "We'll intermarry with you. We'll make one big happy family, but we can't let our daughters marry men who are uncircumcised. So all your men have to get circumcised." And all their men got circumcised. Well, 3 days later, put yourself in the men's position, or don't. They're grown men, not babies, and they're all circumcised. And in verse 25, it says, "Now it came about on the third day when they were in pain," boy, there's an understatement, isn't it? They were in pain, "that two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came upon the city unawares and killed every male." So they killed every man in the city. And it was a scheme. They had set up this scheme. They said, "Okay, we'll let you marry our women if all of your men get circumcised." So all their men got circumcised. And 3 days later, when they were in the peak of agony over the circumcision, Simeon and Levi snuck back into town and killed them all. So do you see where Israel is talking about their violence? That's pretty violent. And that was self-willed violence. That they did that on their own. The future of these tribes is described back up in chapter 49 and verse 7, where it says, "Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." So he's going to disperse them through the tribes and scatter them throughout Israel. That's to be their future. Notice it in verse 6, by last part, it says, "Because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen." They went around and lamed the oxen even so that they couldn't survive. So these guys that's pretty violent. And Jacob/Israel says, your future is going to be dispersed throughout the tribes of Israel. Now, interesting. In the book of Joshua, the first 12 chapters describe the conquest of Canaan, when Israel, the Jews, take over Canaan. Chapter 13 through 21 records how the land was divided after they had conquered Canaan. And it's very interesting. Look at Joshua chapter 19. And we'll see how this prophecy that Jacob made comes to pass. They come into the land, they conquer the land, they're in the land of Canaan now, and they're dividing it up. And what happens? In chapter 19, verse 1, it says, "The second lot fell to Simeon, to the tribe of the sons of Simeon, according to their families, and their inheritance was in the midst of the inheritance of the sons of Judah." So they're dispersed in with the tribe of Judah. So they're just like Jacob said, they're getting scattered throughout the tribes. Look at verse 9. It says, "The inheritance of the sons of Simeon was taken from the portion of the sons of Judah, for the share of the sons of Judah was too large for them. So the sons of Simeon received an inheritance in the midst of Judah's inheritance." See how they're being dispersed throughout Israel? So what Jacob said actually came to pass at a later time. So we have those two sections, and they tell us that this prophecy came to pass. Now, back in chapter 49, verses 8 through 12 talk about Judah. And Judah is the key figure, of course. 8 through 12, "Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches. He lies down as a lion. And as a lion, who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. He ties his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine, and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull from wine, and his teeth white from milk." Now, what does that all mean? Really, it's pretty simple. Levi's tribe... Oh, I skipped a part. Verses 5 through 7, the future of Levi's tribe. Remember, Levi was the priestly tribe. They were given a special privilege, even though they were in cahoots with Simeon over the Dinah thing. They were given a special privilege, and that zeal that they had for their sister was redirected towards something godly, and that something godly was the priestly service. They were given the special privilege of being in the priestly service. So it's an indication of how a misdirected zeal can be directed towards something that's good. Now we get to Judah. In verse 8 through 12. Now, more is said about Judah than any other tribe, as we just read. Judah is to become the leader of the brothers. In verse 8, it says, "Judah's, your brothers shall praise you." So, Judah is the leader, and he always kind of has been. Judah always stepped up first, remember? Look back at chapter 37 of Genesis, in verse 26 and 27, Verse 26 says, Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers listened to him. So when they were selling Joseph off to Egypt, Judah stepped up and said, wait a minute. They were going to kill him, and he said, wait a minute, that won't bring us any profit. Let's sell him instead. And so he stepped up as the leader of the brothers, and they listened to him. Even though that was not a very nice thing to do, he stood up as the leader. In Genesis 44, remember when the brothers, when they accused Benjamin of stealing the goblet, and they brought the brothers back in front of Joseph, and Joseph said, I'm just going to punish Benjamin and the rest of you can go. Well, Judah was the one that stood up and defended Benjamin at that time in verses 14 through 34. In verse 16 it says, so Judah said, what can we say to my Lord? What can we speak? And how can we justify ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's slaves, both we and the one in whose possession the cup has been found. So Judah, verse 18, Judah approached him and said, O my Lord, may your servant please speak a word in my Lord's ears. So Judah has always kind of stepped up to be the leader of the brothers. Well, that's going to continue, of course. He always has a prominent place. In the census of Numbers chapter 1 and chapter 26, again, if you want to read those for yourself, Judah was the largest tribe. And Judah, if you stop and think about it, whenever a descendant of Israel or Jacob, same person, is asked to identify themselves, what do they call themselves? Do they call themselves Ruz because of Reuben? Or do they call themselves Benz because of Benjamin? No, they call themselves Jews because of Judah. In fact, isn't Judah the word for Jew in some languages? I'm pretty sure it is. So he's the one that is identified and characterized as the leader of nation Israel, the tribe of Judah. So that's why even they're called Jews. Now, back to Genesis 49, he will be a conqueror. In the last part of verse 8, it says, your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. So he's going to be a conqueror. And remember, the greatest conqueror in all of Israel's history was David, who was a descendant of Judah. And his son, Solomon, even extended that territory. So Judah was the tribe of conquering, of leadership. He's to become the leader of his brothers. It says that his brothers will bow down to him, a conqueror. He's going to produce the royalty in Israel. In verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. So he's going to be the ruler until Shiloh comes. Now there's a lot of controversy about exactly who Shiloh is, or what Shiloh is. All the legitimate kings of Israel were from the line of David. And that's why Christ had to be connected to the line of Judah, because he was the king of Israel, of course. And a king will not always be on the throne in Israel, but the right of kingship will always belong to the tribe of Judah. Now, the word Shiloh could be translated another way. It could be translated not as a proper noun, the way we have it here. It's Shiloh as a proper noun, like a name. But if you take that word, Shi is a relative pronoun. And La is a preposition, and O is actually a pronominal suffix. That helps a lot, right? Yeah. Well, let me explain. If you put those together, you have a relative pronoun, a preposition, and then a pronominal suffix. It would be who to him, or to whom it belongs. You could translate that. Verse 10 says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until the one who owns it comes," or the one who it belongs to comes. You see that? That's just a little Hebrew grammar that I throw in there, that to whom it belongs would be a translation of the word Shiloh in Hebrew. If you didn't take it as a proper name, that's what it would mean. So what it means is that the millennial kingdom won't come until the one to whom it belongs is here. And that Judah will be the line of kings until the one to whom it belongs gets here. And that's still in the future, when the Lord returns at the second advent and sets up the millennial kingdom. Now, why do I say that? Because it says, "And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples." So Judah's tribe, or Judah, he will be the king, and all the people, not just the Jews, will be obedient to him. "He ties his foal to the vine, his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull from wine and his teeth white from milk." Now, what does all that mean? Well, what all that means is that it will be a dawn of a new age. The language is language of overwhelming abundance. I mean, you don't tie your donkey to your choicest vine. That's not done. I mean, it's an illustration of abundance. You don't wash your clothes in wine. That's not to say that's literally going to happen, unless you like purple clothes, but it just means there's so much abundance that you could do that if you wanted to. You could wash your clothes in wine. You could tie your donkey, your best donkey, just to your best vine, grapevine. So tremendous abundance. And that talks about the millennial kingdom. So the Messiah will bring in a new age. And the language of blessing is used in the last two verses about Judah. You know, tying a donkey to a vine and washing clothes in wine. Great abundance. Kidner says this about it. Kidner's one of the guys that writes commentaries on the Old Testament. "It bids adieu to the pinched regime of thorns and sweat." Remember in the beginning of Genesis, what's the curse? The curse is you'll still get produce from the ground, but it's not going to be easy. It's going to be through sweat. There's going to be thistles. There's going to be thorns. and it's going to be hard. But this is going to put an end to all that when the one who owns the scepter of rulership comes back. Now, I grouped some of the brothers together. And the reason I did this is because some of the brothers, we don't have any historical or biblical references to what happened to their tribes. All we have are what Jacob says about them. So we assume that to be true, of course, but we just don't have the historical or biblical documentation. First, Zebulun, in verse 13, Zebulun will dwell at the seashore. He shall be a haven for ships. His flank will be toward Sidon. So Zebulun, he's going to dwell close to the commercial shoreline of the Mediterranean Sea. After Zebulun, we have Issachar in verse 14 and 15. Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between the sheepfolds. When he saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant, he bowed his shoulder to bear burdens and became a slave at forced labor. Now, this really struck me because here he is, a strong donkey. That means he's a, you know, very powerful militarily. And he finds a place that looks good. So he gives that up in order to have his safety, his well-being, and he lets somebody else worry about that. You know, we'll take good care of you. You just give us your guns. He gave up his freedom for prosperity, what he thought, and protection. And how did he end up? He ended up being a slave. Now, that one just kind of struck me. As you know, I have certain ideas about certain things that don't include giving up freedom for security. Dan, in verse 16 through 18, Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path that bites the horse's heels so that his rider falls backwards. So Dan, and here's Dan, he's smaller than the other tribes, and yet his calling was going to be to help other tribes battle off mighty enemies. So it's kind of interesting to put these two together. Here we have Issachar. He's a strong-boned ass, if you want to read that literally. A strong-boned ass. He's a tough guy. And he gave up his liberty because he didn't want to fight. He wanted peace. He found a peaceful place, so he gave up his army. He laid down his guns. Pretty soon he's a slave. Now, here's Dan, the little guy. And what's his job? His job is to protect and to fight. And he doesn't give up. And in fact, Dan wasn't as privileged as the rest of the brothers because he was born of a concubine and not of a wife. But he would help the people get their rights. So he fought for rights. But he was the weak one. Gad in verse 19. As for Gad, raiders shall raid him, but he will raid at their heels. So Gad is destined to be raided, but he is fight valiantly and he will overcome. Asher in verse 20. As for you, Asher, his food shall be rich, and he will yield royal dainties. I don't know if I'd want to be remembered that way, but he's going to be the cook of the bunch, I guess. His tribe going to be make royal dainties. Again, we don't have any historical data that I can take you to and say he invented Jelly Roll or something like that. But now we have Naphtali in verse 21. Naphtali is a doe let loose, so a free mountain people, but he gives beautiful words, probably a reference to being a fact that his tribe will be messengers. Benjamin, in verse 27, is going to be so successful that he can share with the others. Verse 27 says, Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he devours the prey, and in the evening he divides the spoil. Now, Joseph. Jacob treated Joseph more lavishly than all the others, remember. And this is verse 22 through 26. Remember, I took Benjamin and put him with the other brothers. 22 says, Joseph is a fruitful bough by a spring. Its branches run over a wall. Its archers bitterly attacked him and shot at him and harassed him, but his bow remained firm, and his arms were agile from the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, for there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. From the God of your father who helps you, and by the Almighty who blesses you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, and blessings of the breasts of the womb. The blessings of your father have surpassed the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of the one distinguished among his brothers. Of course, Joseph was the favorite, and Jacob treated him better than anyone else. In verse 2, we have, he's going to be a fruitful bough. He's going to be prosperous, fed by a nearby spring, and his prosperity is going to attract others who attack him. It says the archers bitterly attacked him. And this is the story of Joseph's life, isn't it? From when he was a kid, his success made other people jealous. Always did. His brothers threw him in a pit and sold him off to Egypt. And now, when Jacob is telling about the future of his tribe, they're going to be tremendously successful, and it's going to make everybody else mad. So the archers are going to come and attack him, but God is going to preserve him. And as always, Joseph is defended by the God of his father. Remember, Joseph was always firm in his convictions that supernatural intervention was what caused all his misfortunes. He said, God, it's God that sent me here to Egypt, not my brothers who threw me in a hole and sold me. It's God who led me here. So he will remain the same. And without supernatural intervention, he would not have made it as far as he had. And he admitted that the whole time. God did this, God did this, God did this. The same is going to be true for his descendants. And he will have a position over his brothers, a position of blessing. Blessing, berkot, in Hebrew, is used 5 times in these verses. So the blessings give Joseph a superior position to his brothers. So that's Jacob's prophecies of what will happen to his son. And we'll pick up with the death of Joseph and Jacob next hour and finish the book of Genesis. Father, thank you for your word. In Christ's name, amen.